Sounds True presents Radical Self-Acceptance, a Buddhist guide to freeing yourself from shame, with Buddhist teacher, psychotherapist, and author Tara Brach. And now, Session 1, The Suffering of Self-Aversion.
Now just imagine for a moment what it would be like in your life to be without anxiety about imperfection, not to be numb or uncaring, just simply without anxiety, accepting yourself just as you are, with this body, with this appearance, these behaviors, these life circumstances. One of the most reassuring lines from the Zen tradition was written by Zen Master Dogen, and it goes like this. To be in harmony with the oneness of things is to be without anxiety about imperfection. Without anxiety about imperfection. Now, I love this teaching because it assumes imperfection. It assumes that these bodies and minds will be reactive, that will grasp and get attached, and that will be angry at times and fearful, and that will even hurt the beings that we love the most out of our fear and our confusion. It assumes imperfection and says, what matters is, how do we relate to that? In working with meditation students and clients, it's become increasingly clear to me that the feeling of deficiency is right at the root, right at the center of the most painful and paralyzing experiences. It's right at the root of any fear around rejection. I'm deficient, I'll be rejected. Around our ability to be intimate. Around our capacity to be creative. It stops us. It drives addictive behaviors, this feeling of deficiency. And I've noticed that the most uncomfortable language describing deficiency is feeling shame. We're kind of ashamed about the word shame. And yet I think it's a really important word because it points to the deep pain of self-aversion. And in these talks, I'm going to be using the word shame and self-aversion interchangeably. Shame connotes that sense that our not-okayness is exposed. It's exposed to the world or just to our own awareness. But when we feel deficient and when we're aware of that deficiency, there's a real sense of shame, and that shame ties us up in knots, and it gives rise to the most profound sense of self-aversion. Several years ago, the Dalai Lama was meeting with a group of Western teachers, and he expressed astonishment at the degree of self-aversion and feelings of unworthiness that are reported by Western students. Shame or self-aversion is the most pervasive type of contemporary suffering. And what this means is that for awakening beings of our time, people on the spiritual path, that paying attention to shame, paying attention to self-aversion, is a necessary gateway for awakening. It's not something to get rid of. Rather, the way we pay attention to self-aversion is actually the grounds of the path. It's alarming to me when I realize just how habituated we can get to this perception that something is wrong with me, to feeling fundamentally not okay. It's kind of like an invisible but toxic gas, and we're always breathing it, so we're not quite aware that down deep we've just assumed that something's wrong. And then belatedly we start realizing that we've been living out our days to compensate for this feeling, that our life has been wrapped around trying to avoid feeling bad about ourselves, to make up for not being okay. The way the Buddha described it, spiritual awakening always begins like this, with the recognition of where the suffering is, of really getting how painful it is. And then freedom becomes possible as we begin to relate to this suffering with mindfulness, with great love. Mindfulness and love are the two foundations of what I'll be calling radical acceptance. Radical acceptance, that embracing of our lives, is only possible when we're mindful, when we can see what's happening, and when we can hold it with great tenderness. So in this series of talks, we'll be exploring how to bring radical self-acceptance to the parts of our lives that we've rejected. I remember in one of the first Buddhist retreats that I attended, a teacher saying to us that the boundary to what we can accept is the boundary to our freedom, that our path is to not reject any part of our life. It's what drew me to the Buddhist path, the sense that all parts of life are to be received and honored with a real wakeful heart and mind. So it's my hope that these teachings will help you in embracing whatever parts of life have been excluded from your heart, embracing and re-embracing and re-embracing. It's an unfolding process, probably for a lifetime at least. So in this first of the four talks, we'll look towards the source of feeling deficient. How is it that we come to feeling so unworthy? And we'll look towards recognizing the strategies we've been using to avoid that pain, because it's not until we see the strategies that we can actually heal. In the second talk, I'll be offering guidelines and exercises for relating wisely with the parts of our being that are used to being rejected, our neediness, our anger, jealousy, insecurity. So this means learning to show up with a genuine quality of receptivity when it's been our habit really to ignore or reject a part of our being. In the third talk, we'll explore bringing a deep and a healing presence to what feels most intolerable, what feels really unforgivable about ourselves. And here we'll draw directly on the power of Buddhist mindfulness techniques and heart meditations, practices that cultivate a spacious and wakeful and compassionate awareness. And in this talk, as in all of them, I'd like to invite you to feel free to revisit the meditations, to come back to them again and again, and just practice them in whatever way is most valuable for you. The name of the last talk is The Field of Belonging. And there I'll be describing radical acceptance as really the grounds of the bodhisattva path. The understanding here is that we are all bodhisattvas, we're all awakening beings, and that it's by embracing our inner life that we realize a very natural connectedness and compassion that extends to all beings. We use the word self-acceptance because the starting point is our inner experience. But what it really trains us to do is, in a very unconditional way, in an all-inclusive way, embrace all of life. That's what makes it radical. Perhaps another way of saying radical acceptance is simply being in love with life. In sensing an overview of the healing path, there are two contrasting motifs of spiritual development that I find it's valuable to reflect on. Now, in the first, and this is a more traditional view, the spiritual path is like ascending a mountain of perfection, and our job is to transcend the lower impure self and achieve high and rarefied states of purity and perfection. So So what that means is the seductive realms of sexuality and sensuality and emotionality are to be guarded against with great vigilance. And the feminine side, our earthy nature, is not to be trusted. In fact, we're supposed to control this part of our being. Now, for many of us, this is a familiar part of our cultural inheritance, but interestingly, it's not just Western. It has to do with reacting to the perceived blight of original sin. Something's inherently wrong with me. Carl Jung describes a paradigm shift that's represented by a more mature and friendly vision. So this is the second motif. Rather than a journey towards perfection, our journey is towards wholeness. Rather than ascending upwards, we're turning to embrace this world, this life, in all its realness. Broken, messy, vivid, alive. So we're becoming genuinely intimate with this life. This more friendly vision is beautifully illustrated in the art of Tibetan Buddhism. And here you can find these images of animal-headed deities, these goddesses that are embodying the forces of passion and wrath and jealousy and fear. They're the difficult shadow energies. And you find these goddesses at the entrance to sacred space, sometimes in a temple, sometimes a mandala. And they express an ancient wisdom, and this is that it's by going through the gate that we reconnect with the sacred, that we rest in the arms of the beloved, so that our path isn't to rise above the deities or to wish them away or vanquish them, but rather really to become intimate with them. And intrinsic with this image of moving through the gate is that our essential nature is trustworthy. It's good. That we are awareness. We are love. And that it's through embracing the goddesses, embracing the difficulties, that we actually relax and open into the fullness of our being. It's a journey towards wholeness. There's nothing to strive towards that's outside ourselves. Most of you know the Greek myth of Sisyphus, where he keeps having to push a boulder up the mountain, and of course it rolls down again. In this more mature path of awakening, we're not having to push the boulder, having to go somewhere else and be someone else, because our already naturally wakeful being is right here and now. I love the words of the Indian teacher Sri Punjaji. Before the beginning, you are pure consciousness. You are the fullness of love in love and the emptiness of awareness. You are existence and the peace beyond peace. We are Buddhas. In fact, there's no value to the Buddhist path if it doesn't guide us towards that realization. And we're suffering Buddhas when we don't recognize our nature, when instead we're busy trying to be different. The Buddha described the root of our suffering, of not recognizing our nature, to be our sense of separateness, that we identify our being as a separate self, and that out of this experience of separateness arises all the world of contraction, where we grasp, where we resist. And what happens is we then have a deep aversion towards self, because what's wrong with us is a threat to our survival. So we get into the pattern of pushing away the troublesome parts of ourself, rejecting them, ignoring them, deepening our sense of being separate, of not belonging to our own being or to this world. Wise societies provide means of belonging to family, to tribe, to community, to the earth. And this belonging is what helps to address and heal the primal fears around separation. This is not so in our modern Western culture. We're not a wise society. Chief Standing Bear, a Lakota leader, put it like this. He said, "The white man does not understand America, nature, earth. He's too far removed from its formative processes. The roots of the tree of his life have not yet grasped the rock and soil. The white man is troubled by primitive fears." Because we're separate in this culture, from our earth, from each other, because there's no unconditional sense of community that holds us, this is an incredibly ripe environment for self-aversion to run rampant. We're in a culture that rewards individual achieving, rewards competing and beating others, and devalues those who are different. In our culture, in order to feel even a superficial sense of belonging, we have to jump through innumerable hoops, look a certain way, behave a certain way, and when we fail to jump correctly through these hoops, our very belonging is threatened. So there's a huge fear of failure, of making mistakes. And the result of being so afraid of failure and mistakes is that we go around tense, anticipating what next we could do wrong. The core feeling of unworthiness is really underneath a whole family of difficult emotions. I mean, consider for a second depression. So often we find under depression that core belief and sense, I'll never be good enough. What's under anger or violence towards others? If we look closely, we sense that whenever there's a feeling of insufficiency and another person makes us feel insufficient, we strike out at them. What's the fear of? We're afraid that we'll be punished for inadequacy. And you can see how these emotions and this circling around fear is set in place in a very personal way in our personal biographies. I mean, we each grew up with parents who gave us standards to meet. Be special, look a certain way, act a certain way, work harder, make a difference, don't be demanding, you're too shy, you're too loud. So basically, the message is our natural way of being is not okay, be different. When our mirroring by significant others reflects deficiency, when we're not seen or valued, it just creates more severed belonging. And the real self gets buried, gets pushed away, gets depressed and repressed. So there's this constant gap between who we are and who we think we should be. And that gap, and it doesn't take much for us to feel it, makes us feel terrible about ourselves. And we can just look in a paper and see an advertisement with a skinny model, and that can stir up a basic sense of not okay. Or we can hear about someone else's accomplishments, someone even we care about, and deep down it can trigger off, boy, I'm not really all right. For so many of us, an annoyed tone of voice or some critical feedback can really bring us very quickly to that sense of absolute deficiency. So it's inevitable, given our cultural and personal biographies, that we would be left feeling not good enough and tensing against failure. Shame is the most recent of the affects and emotions to be recognized by psychologists. And there's a reason it's taken so long to see the face of shame. Shame is largely unconscious. It's an invisible backdrop to experience. We can be aware that we judge and blame a lot, but we're usually so caught in the storyline that the more primal fear and shame around failure are not in consciousness. And then what happens? Something crashes in our life. Usually it's a relationship or a job, and then we plunge into angst. Okay, so this is who I really am, a total worthless failure. fundamentally flawed. We get possessed by shame, and there's this wondering, like, I thought I had dealt with this one. You know, those of us that have been through years and years of therapy and so on, and this kind of surprise that we're stuck in this old, familiar place of self-hatred. But that's the way shame works. The very etymological root of the word shame is to cover. This is the function of shame, to avoid exposure of deficiency. So shame both perceives that we're deficient and acts to try to cover it. We try to cover feeling deficient because it's like ego death. It's relational death. If we're defective, it means we don't belong, and that's intolerable. It's really no surprise that in that now famous Harvard study, public speaking was voted the number one fear. Now, this is number one over nuclear holocaust, over other horrors, including personal death. That was number four. We have an enormous fear of being exposed as defective. And because it's so devastating and painful to be exposed, we disguise and compensate for shame with strategies of our personas. These strategies are composed of beliefs and emotions and behaviors, and they're so much a part of how we operate that they really comprise our personality. Now, some of these strategies are considered acceptable, like workaholism, but there are a lot of our strategies that create overt suffering, like addiction. Whether it's workaholism or alcoholism, though, what's lurking underneath and what's asking for attention are the animal-headed goddesses, those rejected, shamed parts of our inner life that in order to heal, we need to relate to. Carl Jung described it this way. He said that our suffering comes from those parts of our psyche that are unseen, that are unfelt. So it becomes really important to take a look at, well, what are these covering strategies? How do I run from shame? And for me, I've found it useful to think of it in terms of three different categories of trying to get away from shame. And one is ways that we flee, that we avoid the feeling. Another is the way that out of that feeling of deficiency, we fight our world. And the third is how we try to conform and compensate and be better and please. And we use all of these strategies, all of us, but it's interesting to find in each of us how some predominate over others. So let's do a quick tour of these strategies and sense as we do what feels like yours, what in some way feels like a reflection of your personality, of ways that you might be moving through life, so that you can, as you go through your days, pay a deeper attention to what's appearing. We'll begin with the strategies of flight, how we flee, how we try to avoid by suppressing and depressing and numbing and denying. Probably the most pervasive way that we avoid uncomfortable feelings is by getting addicted to substances, by in some way using food or alcohol or drugs, although we can also get addicted to sex or work or being excited. But we get addicted to an experience that numbs or dulls or distances us from the feeling of shame. The most common is probably overeating. And in overeating, there's a sense of running from some vague but really intolerable affect. Something's wrong. But there's also alcohol, which is known chemically to reduce shame, and cocaine and other drugs. Now, one way that's very common that we take flight from shame is into depression. And you can consider it that depression really depresses the acuteness of other feelings. Several years ago, I was attending a 3-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. It's a Buddhist meditation center. And I was really excited about this retreat because I hadn't gotten away for a while on a retreat, and I was really looking forward to it being, you know, a chance to get quiet and go deeper into my practice. And within the first few days, I got a very tenacious kind of stomach virus, and it lasted for 2 weeks, which meant that I was sitting and walking and being at retreat for 2 weeks feeling absolutely miserable. But it wasn't just physical unpleasantness. What I found is that I would feel physically sick and then have these long stretches of really being depressed, really feeling down. So I started paying closer attention. And what I noticed is unpleasantness would be there, and then it would turn to fear. And the fear would be, this is never going to go away. I'm going to be sick all of retreat. And then judgment would come up, and the judgment would be, something's wrong with me. Being sick means something is wrong with me in a deep way, that I don't know how to take care of myself, or I'm not a spiritually balanced kind of person. So sick became this reflection of some basic, I'm not okay. It wasn't just unpleasant pain in the stomach. It was deep down, something's wrong with me. I was spending more time in depression than actually feeling the physical elements of being sick. When I could see that, when I could see that the strategy I had locked into was depression, I could come back with mindfulness and catch it before it sunk me into a depression, into that sense of something's wrong with me, I'm bad, ashamed in some deep way. The last type of avoiding shame in this flight category I'll mention is denial. Sometimes we flee by getting addicted to substances, sometimes by depressing it with emotions. But the most common way is to just to ourselves and to the world deny that anything's wrong. We pretend to be okay. And it's an embarrassment to be seen as having trouble, struggling. We don't want to admit how disappointed we are with the way our life is unfolding. So we tend to ignore or deny. And it certainly happens in a big way around sexuality. In spiritual realms, it's sometimes considered that sexuality and pursuing our sex drives is a non-spiritual enterprise. So we don't always acknowledge just the truth of passion, lust, eros. A friend of mine, soon after a divorce, sent me a card. And on the card, you could see a monk writing something on a parchment sheet with a quill pen and writing it over and over and over again. And when you opened it up, it said, celibacy is not so bad. Celibacy is not so bad. Celibacy is not so bad. And you can see how we do it. We try to talk ourselves into what's going to be okay and not admit what's difficult. So there's flight. There's getting away from the sources of our dis-ease. Using eating and drinking and hiding and pretending and denying. A second strategy is that we try to push away shameful feelings. And for me, one of the most glaring examples was in the aftermath of Columbine and some of the other situations with school violence. There was a much closer look taken by many people on how directly the role of shame and alienation gave rise to violence. When there's a dis-ease of not belonging, it's intolerable. People act out of that. For most of us, the most frequent form of fighting is the ongoing violence of judging, blaming, and we judge and blame ourselves and others. The more insecure we are, the more insecure a culture is, the more put-downs. The more put-downs become a reflexive way of communicating. I have a client that's very well-liked, and he's a wealthy, successful, respected person. And yet, in certain areas of his life, he finds that he becomes unaccountably blaming and intolerant and rageful. And one of those arenas is whenever he's around his older brother, who he only encounters during holidays. And what he's recently realized is that since childhood, he's felt inferior to his older brother. His parents, and his brother reinforced this, gave the message that he could never be as good. So he finds that he gets rageful around his older brother and around anyone, usually a male, that reminds him of his brother. Now, we all have this in some way, that certain people and situations will bring up that sense of not good enough. And for many, our way to push away that feeling is to push away the person that brings it up, to distance, to blame them, to judge. We get locked into this dance, especially with those that are closest to us. And it's interesting to look, when we're judging, what is under this? Because very, very often we'll find that when we're in judging mode, deep down, we're feeling insecure, and there's this need to feel right. There's this need for one-upmanship to resurrect our sense of being an okay person. And it's hard to resist when we're feeling down. There's a saying, the world is divided into people who think they are right. And that's the end of the saying. There's a story about a Taoist master who was sitting naked in his mountain cabin meditating. A group of Confucianists entered the door of his hut, having hiked up the mountain intending to lecture him on the rules of proper conduct. When they saw the sage sitting naked before them, they were shocked and asked, "What are you doing sitting in your hut without any pants on?" The sage replied, "This entire universe is my hut. This little hut is my pants. What are you fellows doing inside my pants?" This is a story simply about needing to be right and making someone else feel wrong. And it happens all the time in our life. Groups fight against other groups. People fight against other peoples and family members against family members. And underneath it is this insecurity, feeling not enough. So there's fleeing, there's the avoiding strategies, there's the fighting and judging strategies. And now I'd like to turn to the one that seems the most innocuous in a way, which is the strategy of always trying to be better. This is the strategy of trying to conform and please. Self-improvement is huge in our culture. We're all trying to be better people, trying to perfect our bodies and our minds and our spirits, and it motivates us to read books and listen to tapes and work hard. There's a story that takes place in Washington, I think at a Borders bookstore, where a man asks a clerk, "Where's the self-help section?" And her response, "If I told you that, it would defeat the whole purpose." We're kind of seeped in this sense that, you know, we're supposed to do it on our own and become better and improve what is. So this conforming, pleasing mentality runs by an inner monitor that's always gauging. Am I getting better? Am I meeting the standard? And there's constantly a standard to meet, an internalized standard, the world standard, and there's usually a good distance to go. Probably where we see it most clearly in our life is in our most important worthiness projects. And most of us have them. The areas of our life that we most rely on to feel like we're okay. I'm a good mother. Achieving in a professional way, being a people helper, spiritual worthiness. We have, under all this effort to improve, still this lingering sense that something is wrong, I need to be different. I'd like to tell you a story about spiritual worthiness projects, and I'm the main character in this one. I spent 12 years living in an ashram. It's a spiritual community. And in the first few years, I had this definite idea about becoming pure, that in order to be enlightened, I had to get up early, do lots of yoga and meditation, work hard. And if I experienced negative thoughts, if I experienced unskillful behaviors, do more meditation, work harder. Now, the normal wake-up time for our community was 3:30 a.m., but for 8 months or so, I was getting up at 2:30 to do extra practice to get a bit ahead of the game and to compensate for impurities. And not to say that was my only motivation. There was a great pleasure and joy in some of the states of consciousness I'd experienced and the sense of samadhi. But for sure, I was trying to become a better person. So naively, I assumed it would take about 5 to 10 years of hard work.
And what I did in those first few years is I'd now and then seek out a spiritual teacher that I trusted, and I did seek out a few, and say, well, how can I improve? I'm doing this, this, and this. What will help me to move on? And without exception, each one of them simply said, relax. So my ego was trying to convert spiritual practice into another domain of striving. This was another strategy to make up for not being okay. Gradually, I realized that this kind of striving only reinforced a distrust of myself. Garrison Keillor writes that my ancestors were Puritans from England. They arrived here in 1648 in the hope of finding greater restrictions than were permissible under English law at that time. Now, this is really pushing the boulder. So, conforming, and in conforming, we reform and deform and constrict our natural being to fit these ideas of who we should be. There's a mistrust of our basic nature, and we lose track of realness. In every moment that we are trying to please another, trying to meet a standard, we are in that moment not connected with the kind of vibrance of our own spirit. And we become completely afraid to take risks because we're afraid to make mistakes. And what in life is valuable that comes without risks? We can't even learn to walk without falling down. And we know relationships inevitably involve the risk of being hurt. If we're not free to fail, to get hurt, to get wounded, we can't really live. We can't live fully. We can't love fully. At a Special Olympics track meet, a young girl had just won the 50-yard dash and was jumping up and down all excited. She yelled out to her parents, "Look, Mom and Dad, I won, I won." Her parents instantly burst into tears. At the awards ceremony, the young girl proudly stood there as a medal was placed around her neck. Then she ran over to her parents, who were crying now even more than before. The three of them hugged as the parents kept crying. A Special Olympics official who had watched this whole scene became concerned and went over to the parents and said, "Excuse me, is there anything wrong?" Through her tears, the mother said, "No, nothing's wrong. Everything's right. We just heard our daughter speak for the first time." Our path is to begin to recognize when we're bound up in trying to conform, or when we're lost in trying to avoid, or when we're pushing away what's difficult. Because each one of these strategies that covers deficiency actually creates more of a sense of deficiency. It's been described as secondary shame. Think of it. If you feel inadequate and then get depressed because of it, there's even more of a sense of being defective. In other words, there's another layer of shame added on because we tried to cover and get away from shame. Or if there's anxiety and we overeat, then we feel ashamed of overeating. If I'm feeling inadequate and I get jealous or lash out in some way, in a blaming way, then there's shame about the lashing out. Whatever we do to cover up that feeling of deficiency just deepens the groove, locks it in place. So by living out these covering strategies, we're further distanced from our inner life. We're less capable of intimacy with our world. And we all know this bind. If we don't like a hidden self, a secret self, then there's no way that we can trust or imagine that another being will actually accept us. Our mistrust of our own inner being actually acts to drive away others, and we know the pain of that, of creating rejection because we fear it. In the most basic way, by covering and avoiding, we're not able to face the parts of our life that need the most attention. We're trapped in what Joko Beck describes as a substitute life. This is Suffering Buddha in a contemporary version. And as stated so beautifully by the historical Buddha, It's the not seeing of this suffering that keeps us bound. As a reflection, I'd just like you to explore for a moment. Consider what's difficult to forgive in your life. It might be a behavior towards another, a way you've hurt another person, an addiction, some way that you consider yourself not good, not acceptable. And as you consider this, just sense, what makes this so bad? What makes it so unforgivable? For many of us, what's unforgivable is that we're hurtful, that we'll never be different, that we'll never really be able to belong with others. Sense what's so unforgivable, and then consider what would happen if you did forgive or accept this imperfection. Just take that leap for a moment. What would happen? What would it be like if you could accept yourself just as you are? And as you reflect, include what stops you from doing that. What really stops you from accepting? Take some moments. If I really accepted this addiction, then fill in the blank. It's out of this fear that we keep our strategies going, that we keep being a workaholic to try to compensate for being not okay, that we keep overeating so that we don't have to feel the angst, the unworthiness, that we keep denying to ourselves that we're hurting. We're afraid to really recognize and accept the rejected parts of our inner life. So that's our predicament. We're conditioned to resist, to run and hide and live out the strategies of our personas. This is our conditioning. It's like being in a trance and we're pretty locked in. And our freedom lies in waking up out of that trance and embracing exactly what's here, what's been excluded, what we're afraid of, and embracing that fully in our bodies with kind awareness. Now, this awareness that can encounter the vulnerability has been described as having two wings. The Buddha described it like a bird that needs two wings to fly. And one wing of this awareness is the seeing of what's true, mindfulness, understanding. What's here? The other wing holds with love what is seen, and we need both. It's interesting to consider, if you imagine yourself as a young child, what would be the most important qualities that you would want to feel from your mother and father? And for most of us, those qualities are to feel understood and to feel loved, and we need both, because if we're just loved but we don't feel seen, then we can't trust that love. And if we're seen but we don't feel really genuinely accepted, then that's a painful kind of alienation. We need both. So these very qualities that we would want in an ideal parent are the qualities of awareness that we need to face and embrace shame, to transform and awaken. This is what we can bring to the deities, to our fear, our loneliness, our anger. And in a way, I think of it as spiritual reparenting, that we are learning to cultivate in our awareness those qualities that will allow us to embrace, to reparent, to heal the wounded parts. So this is the power and the potential of radical acceptance, that we develop these qualities of awareness And with those qualities of awareness, accept and awaken out of the trance of unworthiness and into the sense of who we really are. We're learning to bring a meditative awareness to the places that were not seen and loved, to reconnect where there's been severed belonging, to re-include these parts of being into the stream of our life. This is described beautifully by Rumi in his poem, The Guest House. This very being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight, the dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door. Invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So we'll conclude this part of the talks with a reflection again. Just sit and make yourself comfortable so you feel alert and upright, but please be at ease and take some moments if you'd like just to relax your body fully. You might take a deep breath and with the exhale sense a real letting go. Be aware of the sensations in your body. You might feel your shoulders and relax them a bit. Feel where your hands are and soften there. Aware of the sensations in your body. Aware of the mood of this moment, what emotion is present, if any. And without any judgment, just notice how it is. Becoming mindful. Aware if there's thoughts drifting through, of the sounds that are arising around you. And with this open kind of awareness, we'll take a moment to survey your current life and sense where you're aware of there being guests that are unwanted, where you've been judging, in some way disliking parts of your being. It might be that you've felt an aversion to certain emotions, an aversion towards your own anger, depression, fear. It might be that you've been judging your behavior, how you've treated a loved one, a child, a spouse. It might be some aversion towards addictive behaviors. Let this be an opportunity to identify the places where the shadow deities are present and being judged or rejected. And as you're aware of different parts of yourself that you've been pushing away, just sense the intention to move towards accepting and including these energies in your heart. This is an opportunity to recognize the places in your life that are asking for attention, that can become a very beautiful gateway to freedom.